Hi, my name is Jeannie. I'm an alcoholic. I hope I use this mic right. I hope I don't do what Kelly did.
Down just a little bit.
You know, I do what I do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
There we go.
Okay, I'm going to do what I always do when I speak in AA. I'm going to ask God to come in and have him speak the words he'd have me speak tonight. And if you take that moment with me while I do that and you have God open your ears so that you hear whatever it is that you need to hear tonight, if you take that moment with me, please. Thank you. Thank you. Now I'll tell you anything, everything. I would unzip and show you everything on the inside, not in a naked way. Who I am, I would try to show you. I want to thank Mark for inviting me to come and share tonight. Thank you, Mark. He was fabulous. He spoke at our American Martyrs meeting in Manhattan Beach, where there's no smoking in the whole town. And Mark was fabulous. You got, I'm sure, many wonderful speakers here. I want to thank Kelly for bringing me. She came by all the way from Covina and picked me up and drove me all the way out here. And we just had a fabulous day. She's a girl that I sponsor and really, I'll say, the love of my life. I never had a daughter. I have three sons, which you'll hear in my story. But if I had a daughter, I would want her to be exactly like that. But I'd be trying to change her constantly. So it's probably good that I didn't have her. Okay, let's get started. I was born March 30th, 1938. That's rigorous honesty. They talk about that in the big book. I'll be 86 March 30th. And I'm still kicking, you guys, and still looking, so beware. Hello. And it all works. Yet. That's good news for the girls. Ay-yay-yay-yay-yay. This is supposed to be a spiritual meeting. We're in a spiritual place, Jeannie. Shape up. Okay, back to the real stuff. Okay, I was born in Detroit, like I said. My mom and dad were already separated in their own home, but they didn't have enough money to get a divorce. I have an older brother and sister. I was the baby, and I was about less than a year old when my dad got called into the service. Remember, I was born in 38. 44, 42 is when we actually went to war, declared war. But before that, we were building up to war. And so my dad was called back into the Navy, and that kind of made the divorce final. You know, he dropped me, my grandmother, me and my brother and sister, my mom off at my grandmother's house, my mom's mother. And she was French, French-Irish Catholic. And so they dropped us off there, and my mother had to go to work at the federal building downtown Detroit to help support us. We did get an allotment check from the Navy. And it helped our grandmother during this wartime, and it helped us as a family. And one day my mom came home, and she's going to take us kids because she met a guy at the federal building who was to help, he was help quelling the race riots in Detroit at the time. And so he was from another state or another part of our state, I don't know which, and he fell in love with my mother. My mother fell in love with him. And so she came home and she got us all dressed up to go. My brother tells me this story. Most of everything I've known my whole life about me was from my birth certificate. So all these stories are somehow been related to me since then, since I've been reunited with family. So now my mom's going to take us. My grandmother said, you can go live a life of sin. But she said, you're not taking these three beautiful French-Irish Catholic babies with you. She said, you get your head screwed on straight. You can come back and get your children. To this day, I've never laid eyes on my mother. That's why I don't know much about my family history. Shortly after my mom left, my grandmother died of a massive heart attack, leaving us kids orphans. I had an uncle, my brother, my mother's brother, who was like 16 or 17 at this time, and I think he tried to hold the little family together, but of course it was an impossibility. St. Vincent de Paul stepped in, the state stepped in first for us, and then St. Vincent de Paul stepped in. And we were put into an orphanage in Detroit. And shortly after that, everybody was running out of money. We were at war by this time. And they decided to put kids into foster homes. Oh, that feels so good. Man, you guys got some good water here. It's delicious. I don't want to buy a case of it and check into a cheap motel, but it's really good water. Now you know who you got talking to you tonight. So now I'm in 12 different homes before I'm 9 years old when I get into these foster homes. And every time I did something wrong in one of those homes, it was a finger in my face like this. You do that again, you're going back to the home. So every time I went back to the home, I knew I'd been a bad little girl. And they only caught me at half the shit I did, you know. But I go back to that home and I would think to myself, this time it's a fresh start. You know, this time I'm going to be real good at these next house I live in. I'm hoping it's Daddy Warbucks. You guys probably don't even know who Daddy Warbucks was, but little orphan Annie went to Daddy Warbucks. She was an orphan. And I thought, oh my God, so I'm moving again. I'm a very bad little girl. I labeled myself as a bad little girl. Later on, I found out in life that the people that sent me back, usually because they only took us in for the money. They didn't take us in to have a nice little family. They took us in for that $8 a week they got for us. You know, that was all farm women. Their husbands were away in service. And this was like egg money to them, you know, extra cash to them. So some of the reasons they sent us back was because they just didn't need it anymore, that their husbands came home or something happened that, you know, they didn't need that kind of money anymore. So this is what I kind of cloaked myself in the armor of the adult. After about 6 years old in two or three different homes, my brother and my sister were both separated from me. They went on their way to different places, and I went my way to a different place. The last place I left my sister was, I thought we were going together someplace. She knew she was staying in the house and that I was leaving. And she said, boy, when you got in that car and they put that box in after you, she said, your face went to every one of those windows as that car backed out and turned. She said, and the look on your face was beet red and you were screaming. And the thing that God did for me that day, she told me this is later in life, she told me this story. She said, and God did for me that day, I knew they'd bring you back to me because I was the only one that could make you mind. She was like my little mother before that. And the reason they sent me back was because I was getting her in trouble. You know, so this is how I kind of cloaked myself in the armor of the adult. From then on, when I went to your house, I knew it was going to be brief, and I knew we better get acquainted real quick, and I still kind of bring that attitude into relationships, you know. I knew that, you know, I'm going to be sent back, and you guys are going to go about you. So I quit investing in you. I didn't care if you liked me. I didn't care if I liked you. I would learn the rules and regulations, break as many as I could. When you said, thou shalt not, that's when I wanted to. And that's what I did. And so when I went back to St. Vincent de Paul, each time I knew I'd earned it, you know. And the only thing I ever wanted my whole life was to grow up, find a hymn, get married, because that's all I ever saw around me with these farm people, you know, these women that I lived with. They get married and they have kids and the husband would be there and that's all there was to it, you know. So my whole thought in life, I'm going to get married, I'm going to find a guy that wants to have babies because that's what I want. Because I wanted that family that I never had. I wanted to give to my kids the shit that I never got. I wanted to make my family a happy, you know, stay together kind of family. So I married the first guy that asked me. My girlfriend's uncle signed me out of St. Vincent de Paul. Art Judge was his name, from Emmett, Michigan. He signed me out at St. Vincent de Paul so that I could be her lower companion, so that we could hitchhike to Memphis, Michigan. I wish it was Memphis, Tennessee, you know, because Elvis was still alive then. But we'd hitchhike. So he signed me out because I, living with these Catholic people that I lived with, they didn't want me going out at night and hitchhiking to Memphis, you know. So they wouldn't let me go. And my friend wanted a partner. She wanted somebody to hang with. So I moved in with her and her mom, and I had to get a job. I was not quite, I just turned 16. I got a job at Coney Island, and I served hot dogs, and hot dogs were 20 cents a piece. That's how long ago that was, Coney Island hot dogs. And a hymn came in. You know those hymns. Kelly knows those hymns. And he was giving me that look. Kelly knows that look. And I thought, oh my God, this guy likes me. And so later on in life, when I came to AA, my sponsor made me write about it. She said, Jeannie, did you love this guy? You married him. You were 16 years old. You only knew him 3 weeks. Were you in love? And I had to think about it because it had been a long time since I saw that guy, my first husband. And I thought, she said, don't even think about it. Go home and write about it. So I went home and I started writing. Excuse me, I got a burp. I swear something's going on. Anyway, so I started writing, and here's what I wrote. That's why I can tell you about this. I wrote, he was tall, dark, and handsome. Well, he was only dark and handsome, but two out of three aren't bad. And he told me that he came from Ohio. Ohio, how exotic is that? I didn't travel. And then he told me that he worked at the post office. Well, the post office, everybody that worked at the post office, their kids came to school with better clothes, new shoes every semester. The people that worked at the post office, they had that white picket fence outside. Warm glow coming from their living room. Those are the people that work at the post office. Post office is not just a job, it's a career. I'm writing this down then. I had a clipboard then. I thought, oh, and I knew he really liked me. I knew he liked me more than I liked him. And she said, well, how do you know that? And I said, well, because he would wait for my station, and even though your station might be open, he'd wait until I had an empty seat so that he could sit in my station, and then he tipped me really good. I knew he was generous, too. So I wrote all that down, and so she said, well, what else? And I said, well, I knew he didn't have any anger issues. And she said, well, how do you know that? I said, well, I had read this magazine, you know, the kind that you used to have to hide in under your mattress, one of those romance magazines. And they talked about a Caesar salad. You know, this lady was explaining what she was going to fix for her lover. And it was a Caesar salad, and she described it to a T. Oh, she said, they used anchovies in this Caesar salad. And I went, anchovies? And she said, yeah, the consistency, the aroma, the this, you know, I thought, my God, this must be some kind of a new rare vegetable. I'd never heard of an anchovy in Michigan. Vegetables in our salad. And so one day he took me to the drive-in movie in this 3 weeks that he was dating me. He took me to a drive-in movie, and I don't know if you guys even know what a drive-in, you youngsters. But he takes me to the drive-in, and on the way he stopped at a little market, kind of like a little liquor store market. And he's there buying potato chips, Slim Jims, because that's what we ate at the drive-in. And I'm overlooking at the anchovies. And they're not just regular anchovies, you guys. These anchovies were from Portugal. And so I had two cans of them in my hand when he came up beside me, and he said, well, what is that, Jeannie? And I said, well, those are anchovies. You put them in a salad, but I, you know. He said, well, what is it? I said, well, I think it's some kind of a rare vegetable. Yeah. And he said, well, how much are they? And I said, well, they're 10 cents a can. He said, get two. That's my man. I got anchovies in the backup, you know what I mean? So now I'm in the car. I already have the ism. I'm not drinking yet, but I have the ism. I've maybe had a couple of seven and sevens, you know, at a wedding or something, but I was not drinking. And so I'm trying to open this can of anchovies because I have the ism and I want it now, you know. And so I couldn't get it open. And he, don't worry about it, Dal. Look like you, kind of. Don't worry about it, Dal. He said, just reach in the glove compartment there. He said, I got a tool in there. It'll help me open it. So I hand him the can, and I reach in, and I think it's a screwdriver. I hand that over to him, and he gets it going. He's driving at the same time, you know, and the sun glistened in as he opened it, and I guess it looked like they were moving. And he handed them back over to me, spilling this anchovy juice over everything. You know, but did that stop him from kissing me all night? No, he didn't care that I smelled like a dead fish. He cuddled me the whole night of that movie. And he never swore, he never cursed about it, he never slammed anything. He didn't get angry over that horrible thing. So I knew he didn't have any anger issues. And so she goes, well, okay, I guess that gave you some information. So anyway, 3 weeks later, he asked me to marry him. And because I've been taking notes about him all this time, I say yes. And he can't marry me in the state of Michigan because I was too young. He had to take me across the state line. My girlfriend's uncle, Art Judge, that signed for me to get out of St. Vincent Paul, signed for him to marry me. And when we're filling out the paperwork in front of this judge, I see a lady's name. It says Phyllis Lane. My husband's name was Bert Lane. Phyllis Lane. And I went, oh, who said Phyllis Lane? Oh, don't worry about it, honey. We'll talk about it on the way home. Well, I find out on the way home it was his first marriage. It was, you know, he was a little bit older than I was, and he was quite a bit older than I was, and it was his first marriage. And that kind of should have given me a red flag, but the fact that the judge's name was Judge Mudge was a bigger red flag than her. And so, because I thought that might be not a good sign, you know, something about that didn't sit well with me. So we drive back to Michigan from Indiana. We drive back to Michigan, and they're selling black sweet cherries on the way. That was kind of our honeymoon from there to there, you know, which was like 12 hours or something. And we bought black sweet cherries on the way home, and, you know, I'm married now, and I've got my wonderful husband that's from Ohio, and he works at the post office, and I can't wait till I find out that I'm pregnant. And so we get home, and he goes to work, and I go to work. And one day I got home early, and I'm making dinner for us. We live on Main Street in Port Huron, Michigan, and it's winter. And the reason I remember this is because I'm cooking beans. My husband loves Spam, and he loves it crispy. So I'm baking the Spam. I've heated up my whole kitchen with the fried potatoes and the beans and all that. And the steam on the windows, you know, and the place smelled like fried onions. I mean, just homey, you know, just, I have the little white apron on because it's the 50s, remember? And so he comes in from the post office, clean and fresh looking, and I said, oh, hi, honey, you're back from the post office. Yeah, he said, guess what? Well, you know me, I love surprises. I go, what? He said, the job of the post office is finished. I went, finished? What about that wind, rain, sleet, and snow shit? Finished? That job is never finished. What are you talking about? He had failed to tell me he was painting the post office. And him and his entire painting crew were going back to Ohio. Ohio, remember? I'm sure. This is the only thing that saved his butt was, I'm going to go to travel. Now I'm going to travel to Ohio. How exciting. So we pack up. We go back to Ohio. He couldn't find work in Ohio, so he reenlisted in the 82nd Airborne. When we get down to Fayetteville, North Carolina, I find out that I'm pregnant. I have my first baby born December 27th, 1957, in Fayetteville. I get pregnant right away again. I have my second baby boy born in December 28th, 1958, in Germany, Heidelberg, Germany. And then my third baby, just before we came back from Germany, was born February 29th of 1960. We missed 59 by 2 months. And I had these three little babies. And my husband was staying out late at night a lot. And he told me he was working at the Officers Club as a bartender which I believed wholeheartedly. And one day I went to a company picnic kind of party, and a gentleman there came up to me. He was from Detroit, and he said, "Oh, I hear you're from Detroit. Your husband tells me you're from Detroit. Whereabouts?" And I told him. And he said, he sat down next to me, and he said, "I'm going to tell you a little something." He said, "Your husband's been," and he told me the girl's name and how long they've been dating and all this stuff, which I kept secret. I called his company commander when we got home. And the company commander said, "Well, you're going to be going back to the States in a couple of months." He said, "Just stick it out, you know." And he talked to my husband and said, "You better take good care of this lady because, you know, you're going to be in trouble." So when we came back to the United States, my baby was brand new, my third baby, Daryl. And I kind of said, "This is it, you know, it's over." And he said, "Of course," you know, he knew he was going to send back for that lady anyway, which I think he did, but I don't think that lasted very long when he got back to his next tour of duty. So he dropped me off at my girlfriend's uncle, Art Judge. He had built three little cement block houses. I rented one of those houses. I had that allotment check coming. He went on to his tour of duty. I look back at that time as the best time of my life. I didn't have that guy to have to worry about. I just had my babies. I'd throw them a Spam sandwich every once in a while. I had a big backyard. You know, I kept that house immaculate because I'm living in that all-Irish town with all these Irish women. I'm sure they're going to come over any minute with the white gloves and see if I dusted. You know, so I'm trying to keep appearances, and everything is going really good. One day I go out there to get that allotment check. There's no money. And that went on for 3 months. I literally saw my children starving. I remembered I was Catholic all of a sudden. I didn't get married in the Catholic Church. And I went to Father Farrell. He helped me some. He got in touch with the Red Cross. I finally got in touch with that husband. And I said, "You better come." Before that happened, one day I'm, you know, starving. And there's a knock on the door. And I'm thinking, I can't afford anything. These salespeople, I better tell them to move on. So I opened the door to tell them to move on. And there was four or five boxes in front of them. And they said, "They're not selling anything. They have brought something from the next town over, Memphis, Michigan, that they heard there was a family in trouble, me and my kids, and we brought the food for them and you." I went, "Oh my God." A wave of shame came over me, a wave of guilt on not being a good mother. All these things I've been telling myself for the 3 months that I wasn't capable of feeding my children. All these stories I was telling myself about how bad a mother I was and stuff, it hit me like in my heart. This is proof that even the neighbors, everybody knows I can't take care of my kids. And I'd like to tell you that I was very grateful and I showed them my gratitude. But the truth of the matter is that shame and guilt bars us from one another. It's a block between you and me. When that shame and guilt is in front of me, I can't see you and you can't really see me. Those people sensed there was something, you know, that I felt uneasy. So they kind of backed away and told me to enjoy. The kids and I brought that stuff in and we did. We danced around it. That's how grateful we were. 2 days later, there's another knock on the door. This time, I thought to myself, I already had righteous indignation, even though I'm not drinking yet. I had that righteous indignation that they talk about in the big book. I thought to myself, what do they think? We're some kind of gluttons here. They're going to bring me more stuff. And this time I opened the door. These people didn't wait to talk to me for me to invite them in. They pushed past me. The guy came in first. He went into the kitchen. The two women stood in my living room and they said, "We're here to take your children. We're going to put your children in foster homes until you can get on your feet." The minute I heard foster homes, my face flushed. I felt like my head swelled up. I could hardly hear what they were saying, but they were saying things like, "We'll get you an education. You're incapable of making enough money to provide for your children. You can't afford a babysitter and rent. So we'll get you an education where you can get a better job, and then you can have your children. You'll get your children back, blah, 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 whatever." I couldn't even answer him. The guy came out of the kitchen, and he said, we can't take your children today. And they said, well, why not? The women said, well, why not? We're ready. And he said, because her cupboards are filled with food. God had done for me and provided for me way back then what I couldn't do for myself. And so it gave me time to get Father Farrell and got in touch with my husband, and he came across country. I said, you better come. They're going to take our kids. And I must tell you that he offered to take me as well. He said, Jeannie, I'll get you a rooming house. We'll take the kids. He already had Carla. We called her Carla, the midget behind her back. He already had that girlfriend, Carla, and they're going to take good care of my kids kind of thing. And you can just kind of help out and babysit and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I went across country with him once, never again. So I went back and forth and visited those kids. I said goodbye to my children that day thinking, I'll get a great job, I'll make more money, or I'll find a him with a lot of money, one of those two. Because I was so overwhelmed with the fact that I thought once you got that man, he was yours to keep. I didn't realize that men fooled around, you know, I was different than Kelly. I didn't think a guy could lie to you. Why would he tell you that he loved you and then go with somebody else? I just couldn't wrap my brain around. I was devastated by that divorce and that breakup. So now I'm go back to work. I'm working in a bar now. I'm not old enough to serve drinks, but I'm old enough to hostess. I'm going back and forth to see those kids every time I can scrape up $12 for the bus fare to get to Kansas City, Missouri, or to, at this point, he was in, where was he? He was in St. Joseph. So I got enough just to go see those kids once every 3 weeks, once every 4 weeks. And so now what do? By this time I'm drinking because I don't have my kids with me. And I'm drinking a lot because I need distraction. And I'm partying a lot because you better take me to the best bar. You better buy me that best steak. You better buy me that Prada purse or that Chanel. You know, I'm getting a little wiser now. And I'm going back and forth to see those kids, and I stay with him 3 days, and I drink all the way over there, and I drink all the way home. I'm taking whites before I go so that I can work two shifts back to back. I'm cleaning that house from top to bottom because I want it fresh when I come home. And I'm lying to my children. Every time I go to see my kids, I'm saying, next time mommy comes, mommy's going to have her own apartment, her own car, and a job. Next time. Next time mommy comes, mommy's going to take you with her. Next time. You know, and I knew every time I got on that Greyhound bus, this wasn't going to be the next time. So I had to have a little bigger bottle of something when I went on that trip. And the last time I went on that trip, I had a big bottle of Southern Comfort. I have it in my purse. I'm sitting right behind that bus driver on that Greyhound bus. He always knows the best place to get the biggest drink. And so I'm taking a little sip out of that Southern Comfort, and I hear a guitar playing in the back. You know, I'm dating every guy that comes through that, all the musicians that come through my bar. You know, they play 2 weeks, and they go on to the next place. I love guitar players. So I turn around and look, and here's the most handsome guy I ever saw in my life. Long blonde hair, no shirt on, no hair on his chest. That was different. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, he's giving me that look. And I think, oh dear, I have no makeup on. I go to the first stop that we take, we stop at, and I go to the restroom, and I start putting on my makeup. Well, you know, I've had those whites, and it takes a long time when you got whites to even change your mirror. And I put my face on, and I go out to that bus to jump on to see where my future husband's sitting, and guess what? That bus is long gone. And so what do? There's a big sign that said lounge, right into the lounge. And I work at a bar, so I know how to take care of a bartender. I put $5 on the bar. $5 back then was a lot of money. And I go, please, make sure I get on that next bus. I'm going to go see my kids in Kansas City. Make sure I have, I get on that next bus. Well, I guess he didn't make sure. And I went through a couple, three changes of shifts in that bar. And finally, they poured me into that bar, into that bus, the second bus or third bus, I don't know which. And so I can't sleep because I'm still wired and I'm drunk. And my husband meets me, and he's been there to meet two buses earlier, which I missed, so he's not happy. And so I know he's going to be talking out of the side of his mouth at me because he never wants to look me straight in the face and talk to me because he hates me and I hate him. And so I try to get off that bus, you know, and it's got that accordion pleat door. I push against it and down I go right in front of him. I fall at my husband's feet. And he picks me up and tries to dust me off a little bit because I got drinks spilled all down in front of me. I'm wearing the same dress I had on 2 days ago. And he goes, "Ginny, what are you doing with yourself? Every time you come, there's a little less of you. I can't bring your kids to you looking like that." And that pierced my heart. First time I heard truth, that pierced my heart. I thought, what he's telling me is the truth. I am, my life is spiraling down. I know one more time I'm going to lie to my children and to him. He said, "I'll put you in a hotel room. You stay the night." And he said, "I'll bring the kids to you tomorrow and take a shower, and I'll bring the kids to you tomorrow." And I guess he came the next day, but because of my being up all that time, I didn't hear him knock on the door. And then the next day he did come, and I did open the door. I still have no clothes or anything. I've spot cleaned that dress that I dragged in for 2 days. And he comes in with a briefcase. And I peek out, and I see Carla sitting in the front seat where I should be sitting. My kids are sitting in the back seat. And Bert comes in, and he said, "Ginny, I want you to sit down at this table. I have a proposition for you." And he picks up this briefcase, and I'm wondering, he never carries a briefcase. He puts these papers across to me, and it's got a judge's signature. And it's, "I'm signing my children over to my husband." And I look at it, and I read it, and he explains it. And I'd like to tell you that I went to every court in the country and fought for my kids. But the truth of the matter is, when he pushed those papers across and I signed them, there was a sense of relief. I'm not going to have to be a mother. I'm not going to have to suit up and show up and come across country to visit my children. I'm not going to have to be good anymore. Now I'm going to have some time for me, me, me. That's where my drinking took me. So now he puts me on the Greyhound bus to go back. I did what they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mourned my children on that bus ride home. From then on, if you said, "Ginny, do you have children? Have you ever been married?" I'd say, "Yes." "Do you have children?" I'd say, "No." I couldn't stand the look on your face knowing what I knew. Who better than I knew what kind of a mortal sin it was to leave your children behind? You know, but that's what I did. I signed my kids over. Now I really got to have a distraction. Now you really got to take me the right place. I'm still working at my girlfriend's uncle's bar. The guy that owns the bar down the street, George Joseph, comes in one night. He's there almost every night. He kind of counts heads to see how many people we got at our bar compared to his. And he said to me, "Ginny, I don't know." He said, "You're not going to be able to make any money in this town." He said, working for the money that you made. He said, "Why don't you go down to Detroit? I heard they're opening a Playboy Club down there." He said, "And you're cute enough, you could do it." And I went, "Playboy?" I had no idea what it was or what he was talking about. And he said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Don't we love that language?" I go, "What?" He said, "I'm going to bring you the money in a plain brown envelope. You go to Detroit. If you make it at Playboy, you can pay me back. And if you don't make it, come back here. If Charlie Elias doesn't hire you at his bar here, I'll hire you at my bar." So what did I have to lose? I went, "Okay, nothing to lose." I get on that Greyhound bus. I make it at Playboy. You know, they tried a costume on me, and they looked at my legs and kind of like a dog or a horse. And I had no idea what I was in for. I kind of got a glimpse of what it was going to be like when they answered the door. They took me down these steps to a basement area, and there was a crowd like this, not quite as many, maybe 40 women. These were girls, hair piled up to here, long eyelashes. Their hose had seams in them, with butterflies at the ankle. I went, oh my God. They had real fur coats on, you know, real fur. They had, I could smell the French perfume. I thought, I had a little white cloth coat on. My hair was long and straight and bangs because I wanted to be a hippie, but I was too late. And so the guy happened to be, the guy that answered the door that day happened to be from Playboy Corporate. And he was there teaching the bartenders how to do everything about Playboy. And so when he took me into Claire's office, my bunny mother, he took me into her office and he kind of flung me in there. She thought I was a friend of his, and because he's from corporate, she's going to give me extra attention. And that's how I got the job. She handed me that thing, you know, the back of what the Playmate is on. Not that you guys ever looked at the back of it, but the back of it would tell what the girl's age was, where she went to college, you know, what she did for, you know, a hobby. And so I had to answer all that stuff. Well, I lied my way through it. They said, I love the horseback ride. What does it say?
5 minutes.
Huh? 2 minutes.
Huh? 2 minutes. 2 minutes? Oh, my God. Oh, I got to get sober. Oh, my God, did that fly by. And so anyway, I became a Playboy bunny. I worked for half for 11 years. I flew that Playboy bunny jet. I'm working at the Marriott Hotel. My bartender happens to live next door to me. Jackie is her name, Jackie and Jay Stinnett. You guys probably have heard of him. Anyway, he was my guru coming into AA. Well, when I heard that knock, we had a common wall. When she knocked on the door, that told me, Jackie wants to go out drinking tonight. Well, I'm a full-fledged alcoholic. I have been saying for 10 years I'm an alcoholic, so it wasn't hard for me to admit that when I got here. But Jackie knocked on that door. That tells me Jay must be going to one of those Alcoholic Anonymous meetings. Jackie wants to go out drinking tonight. And sure enough, we go out drinking. We come traipsing home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, banging in. We didn't care if we woke that damn alcoholic. And one day she came into work after several months, and she looked great. She had a big smile. I hadn't seen her for 30 days. And I said, Jackie, where have you been? And she said, I went to Mexico. She actually went to rehab. And she said, guess what? I said, what? She said, I'm 30 days sober. I went, Jackie, you, why? Why? She was a lightweight compared to me. She drank beer out of those long neck bottles right out of the bottle, and I drank bowls full of Southern Comfort, bowls full of Black Russian. That's how I ordered it. That's how I got it, because I'm in the bar business. And so when she tells me I had to go have a drink out of this drink I got going on in a bus van in the service area just to talk to her about her going to AA. It was a margarita. I wiped the salt off my mouth and I said, Jackie, so tell me about this AA shit. I said, I'm not ready to go to those meetings. She said, oh, don't come till you're ready. She said, they got shit hanging on the walls. They got bumper stickers. They got a book. They got a big book of their own. I went, a big book? How big is it? Will it fit my Volkswagen? Now she said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Don't we love that language? I go, what? She said, I'm going to bring you the big book in a plain brown envelope tomorrow night. You know, she said, and if you read it, you'll have a chance. And, you know, she brought me that big book, this beautiful big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the inside, she wrote, Dear Jeannie, this plain white sheet. Dear Jeannie, she wrote on it sideways, Dear Jeannie, I understand that this program actually works. I'm praying that it'll work for the two of us one day. Love, Jackie. I went, oh my freaking God. I said, I gotta read that book. I didn't read the book thinking I was gonna get sober. I read the book so that I could not have to lie to her and tell her that I did read that book. And so I started at the back of the book, just like you guys did, and I started reading those stories. I did that for almost a year. Sometimes it held my door open so that when people were partying at my house, it didn't slam. Sometimes it held my couch up because the roller was missing from it. That big book served a lot of service for that first year I had it. And one day, not unlike any other day, I had to never said I was going to quit drinking. It was my medicine. I said, I better start reading that book. I better start at the front of the book. There's a chapter there, they call it How They Do It. Today I know it is chapter 5 and how it works, you know. And I went home and I read chapter 5 and went. By the time I got through the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, doctor's opinion, I identify Bill's story, I got some hope, maybe I could do this. But then I got to the chapter 5 and there's the part that it said, there are those two who cannot be rigorously honest. My whole life had been a lie. I'd lied to you about anything and everything. Everybody in my life had been a lie. I'd stayed current stuff, but nothing about my past. And so I thought, I'm not going to be able to get it. But I had enough hope from Bill's story to read further. And I read that part, A, B, and C, that God, you know, God could and what if he were sought. And I looked up at that God of my understanding. I had that book across my chest, and I said, I'm not seeking, I'm begging. You know what's going on in me. I can't trust people enough to be open and honest. You're going to have to let me know that you're there. And I swear to God, I have what they talk about in the big book, a bush-burning variety of a spiritual experience. God actually spoke to me. First thing that happened was my stomach moved around. I mean, I had rolls going on in my stomach, kind of like it is today. No, bigger and better. And I finally had to, the parts that had produced those children seemed to go back into place. And my heart healed over, and there was a warmth and a sound of, I know I've got it. I know you can do it, was the sound. I don't know if it was God's voice or whose voice, but I know you can do it. From that day to this, I've never had a drop of alcohol. From that day to this, I did take a little hit off of an outside issue, so I set my sobriety date back. I only have 36 squeakily clean and sober March 30th. April 22nd. Squeaky clean and sober. You know, because I did the work, the little bit of work that were required here in AA, I didn't come here to get my children back. I was never going to darken their doorstep again. They were practically adults by this time, and they didn't need a mother now. My one son was in the service already. He was in the Navy already. Randy, my middle son. And so, but I had to do that ninth-step letter. You know, I had to write my, because they were the top of my amends list when I finally got to it. And so I wrote to my kids, and I wrote things like, if you only want to come and see me out of curiosity, I'm available to you today. I hadn't been available to me, let alone to anybody else. I'd never been truthful, open, and honest. And so I wrote those kinds of things that, you know, just if you want curiosity, come. My door is open to you. My sponsor said, you better be wary. You might have a serial killer out there waiting for you, you know, which could have been, but I had no fear. I had no fear. I knew God was with me. And that was at 2 years sober. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous and what you guys have done for me. For the first time in my life, I feel safely held. And I want to thank you all for that. Thank you.